Good afternoon or good evening, or both. So that's a sound check as well as a salutation. Nobody is saying that they can't hear me? Okay. So I want to ask and attempt to answer an unanswerable question: what is Zen? So I'll start off with a quote, a kind of a classical statement as to what Zen is. And the classical, I'm supposed to be recording this. I think it's recording. Okay. So the classical statement goes like this: a special transmission outside the scriptures, without dependence on words or letters, a direct pointing to the mind, seeing into one's true nature, realizing Buddhahood. So to unpack that a little bit: a special transmission outside the scriptures. So we can read books, and those books can inspire us to practice. But the special transmission outside the scriptures is that the books themselves, or the content of the books, will not actually give us what we're looking for. Now, as I say, they can inspire us, they can inform us, they can help us, but they cannot communicate what it is that we really want. So a special transmission outside the scriptures without dependence on words or letters, which would apply to this verse itself, right? This verse that I'm quoting is made up of words and letters. It's kind of a scripture. But it's telling us that Zen is outside of these words and letters. A special transmission outside the scriptures without dependence on words and letters. That tells us what it is not and where it is not. And then it tells us what it is: a direct pointing to the mind. Okay, a direct pointing to the mind. And then it continues: seeing into one's true nature, realizing Buddhahood. So a direct pointing to the mind is what we try to do in Zen practice. We set things up so that beings, you and me, can have this experience of seeing into our own true nature. Things are set up to be a direct pointing to the mind. That's my take on it. That's our formality. This part, seeing into one's true nature, dovetails with classical, or with earlier Buddhism, where you realize the cessation of dukkha by insight into the true nature of reality. Okay, so the the whole of the Buddhist path is leading up to insight, insight into the true nature of reality, and that insight coincides with the liberation, a liberation from dukkha, or a liberation from what I could call the tyranny of self. So it's the freedom from the tyranny of self that gives rise to insight, or it's the insight that gives rise to freedom from the tyranny of self. And this verse of what Zen is dovetails with that. Seeing into one's true nature, you realize Buddhahood. So seeing into the fiction of self, you realize non-self, which is Buddhahood. So that's this statement. That's a classical statement of what Zen is. You may find it inspiring, or you may find it, that's not what I want. Okay. To say a little bit more, it's this idea of a direct pointing to the mind. This direct pointing, we could say, is all around us. It's happening all the time. But sometimes it takes something a little bit more obvious than what's there. So it's always there, it's always around us. We have this saying in Zen that inanimate objects teach the Buddha Dharma. And then there's this whole debate in modern thinking, what is an inanimate object? And maybe that debate was even around 2,000 years ago. Are there really any inanimate objects? Well, what we understand to be inanimate objects, because that sentence has to make some sense, there are inanimate objects. So whatever we understand by that, they teach or preach the Buddha Dharma. So how could that be? All that is in existence is preaching or teaching the Buddha Dharma. It is preaching or teaching emptiness. It is preaching or teaching no self. A great way into this, as far as I can see, is poetry. That was one of the things that drew me to Zen practice, was the poetry of Zen. I had been practicing with a group called the Western Buddhist Order, and I'm very grateful for the 4.5 years that I spent practicing with them. I need to correct myself. The group was called the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. And as I say, I'm deeply grateful for the years that I spent practicing with them. But I felt that there was something more for me with Zen practice. And part of what drew me to Zen was the poetry and the emphasis on the idea that what you are looking for is directly in front of you. Somehow, I felt that made complete sense, that the truth I was looking for, the whatever it is, whatever it was that I was looking for, it had to be everywhere, it had to be in all of reality, and not just some special part of reality that I would get to in the future. It had to be everywhere. So there we have the story that I told this morning, where the experienced practitioner says to the newcomer, "This is it." And that's it. If we can say that to ourselves from time to time, and just listen, this is it. And when you understand that, you don't have to do any other practice. You may choose to do another practice, but you don't have to. You've realized it. Then we get back into our lives and it may seem a little bit like we've lost it. We can try the same thing again. This is it. And it mightn't work. It doesn't really feel like this is it. So we keep practicing. And practice opens us up to this sense of this is it. The totality is here. I was going to say, and I'm part of it, but yeah, that's true and not true. So poetry. Poetry is a beautiful way in to this totality of being. And I want to share a poem or two with you. But before I do that, I'd say, in the ceremonies where you receive the precepts in Zen, there are some beautiful lines, phrases, words, scriptures. And one of them is, "From now on, all beings are your teacher." Can also be phrased as, "From now on, all being is your teacher." So with that in mind, I want to share some poetry with you. First poem is probably my favorite poem of my favorite poet, and it's very short. Patrick Kavanagh, whom some people will be fed up with me quoting at this stage. So the poem is called "Wet Evening in April." The birds sang in the wet trees. And as I listened to them, it was 100 years from now, and I was dead. And someone else was listening to them. But I was glad I had recorded for him the melancholy. I often, when I think this poem, when I recite it to myself, I often tried changing the last word. I was glad I had recorded for him the beauty. Or I was glad I had recorded for him the subtlety, or whatever. But the word the poet used, melancholy, just kind of fits in with dukkha. So, the birds sang in the wet trees. And I have to say, doesn't always feel like they're singing. Sometimes feels like they're fighting or arguing. But occasionally they do sing. And as I listened to them, we don't always listen to them, but sometimes we do. It's really beautiful if you're outside or even inside and you hear the song of a blackbird or a thrush or one of these sweet singing birds rather than a crow. But maybe you like crows. Birds sang in the wet trees, and I'm with it. Yeah, I can get that. I can hear the birds singing, and I'm listening to them. But as I listen to them, it's 100 years from now. That's where it becomes a little bit strange. So it's an imagination that in 100 years from now, there will be somebody else listening to what I'm listening to now. So this interweaving of time and experience, this overlapping, this sense of interconnectedness, or what Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing, that I share this experience with other people who listen to the birds singing in the trees. Birds sang in the wet trees, and as I listened to them, it was 100 years from now, and I was dead. So there's this sense of, as I listen to them, I'm dead. So being here and not being here at the same time. If there is nobody there to hear the birds singing, do they make a sound? I'm sure they do, because the birds are there. They understand what they're saying. But there is this old thing that if a tree falls in the wilderness and there's nobody there to hear it, presumably no birds there either to hear it, no animals there to hear it, if it happens in a kind of ecological vacuum, does it make a sound? What is sound? It's the transmission of pressure through the air that arrives on your ear. So without the pressure traveling through the air, there is no sound. But also without the ear to detect that pressure, there is no sound. So I guess the answer, if a tree falls in the wilderness and there is no ear there to hear it, then there is no sound. So the birds sang in the wet trees, and as I listened to them, it was 100 years from now, and I was dead, and someone else was listening to them. Who is that someone else? Who is listening to them? So that's one poem. Another poem, also by Patrick Kavanagh. It's called That Garage. The lilacs by the gate, the summer sun again, the swallows in and out of that garage where I am. The sounds of land activity, machinery and gear. This is not longevity, but infinity. Perhaps a little bit too facilely romantic, we must stop and struggle with a mood that's getting frantic, getting Georgian, Richard Church and Binion, and stand and plan more difficult dominion. It's the first half, or actually one line in the first half. This is not longevity, but infinity. And we can sometimes get a sense of that, maybe while you're sitting on a bench or lying on the grass, the whole works, the whole being is there. it's just everything going on around you and in you and through you. The lilacs by the gate, the summer sun again, the swallows in and out of that garage where I am, the sounds of land activity, machinery and gear. This is not longevity, but infinity. And in reading or hearing this poetry, you can sometimes tantalizingly feel close to what he's talking about. Or you can actually recognize that experience. I've had it. This sense of just openness. Openness. You can do this also. I know some of you are from London, which is a very busy city. You can do this in a busy city. If you are walking through the city and you just stop for a moment and let all the hustle and bustle go on around you, if you can drop your agenda where you are going right now and just let it all go on around you, you can have that very similar experience of this is not longevity, but infinity. So, what is Zen? On the one hand, there is this kind of the experience that we could call Zen. And in that case, Zen is everywhere. It's open to everyone. You don't have to practice Zen Buddhism to experience it. You can be a poet or an artist or a member of the Western Buddhist Order. Sorry. It's like universal. It doesn't belong to any school. It doesn't belong to any individual. There's no, we talk about the gateless gate. There's no barrier. Okay, and that is the only barrier, is how do I pass through the no barrier? Right. So you step through this barrier, that which is no barrier. This barrier of infinity, you cross a threshold from separation to no separation. And separation is what we impose on reality in order to function in reality. But in imposing that separation on reality, we lose it. We lose the totality. So we're only seeing one half of the equation. We're seeing the separated half, or the, if they think of it as a coin and one side is blank, no separation, and the other side has details, a map on it, that's the side we're looking at. But it helps us to see the other side. So, in the one hand, if we're calling this totality Zen, it doesn't belong to anybody, and it doesn't belong to any school. It doesn't belong to the schools that call themselves Zen. It is what Suzuki Roshi describes as things as it is. So there you've got the things as the relative and it as the absolute. Or you've got the many and the one. Things as it is. On the other hand, we have this phenomenon called Zen. You've got different schools of Zen. So this could be understood as devotees of this experience. And the two most prominent schools of Zen would be Soto and Rinzai. I took the Soto path, but it was part of me thinking I should take the Rinzai path. The Rinzai path seemed much more energetic and much more energetic, determined. Yeah, they're the ones that use koans. Koans such as, what is the sound of one hand? It's usually rendered as, what is the sound of one hand clapping? But I think it is best expressed as, what is the sound of one hand? Okay. Other koans would be, show me your face before you were born. So I really like these koans. Apparently there are answers to them, but you won't get to them by rational thinking. In fact, if you apply rational thinking to them, if you stay with it long enough, you will exhaust your rational thinking, and that is the value, because when you get to the end of that rational thinking, you're more likely to see things as it is, or you're in a better position to just be there with the totality, because you have exhausted this rational thinking. But there was no real opportunity that I could see, or easy opportunity, to practice Rinzai. So I took the opportunity that was there. I went first of all to Thrussell Hole and was impressed with their practice, but didn't really like what I thought of as the kind of Christian flavor. But I thought, you know, they're pretty sincere and their effort is really good, and if I need to, I can come back and practice with them. I went on to California and I really connected with the way they were practicing Zen in California and stayed. And it turned out to be a Soto Zen school. So in Soto Zen, it's not that we don't have koans, it's just that they're not emphasized as part of the practice. The understanding in Soto Zen is that life will present you with its own koans, its own paradoxes, its own riddles, its own difficulties. And our way of practicing with koans is to sit with them, as with Rinzai. So the koans that you may be presented with, they're the usual things that life throws at us. Should you take this job or not? Or a partner walks out on you? Or you're debating whether or not to leave your partner? These are koans, these are perplexities of the heart. You have to go in for surgery. Yeah, don't want to go in for surgery, but you have to. Okay, go. How do we deal with the conflict that generates? or the loss of a loved one, raising the question, what is life about? What makes it worthwhile? So these experiences of life, when we're practicing, teach us. It's like in that line of the precept ceremony, from now on, all beings are your teacher. From now on, all being is your teacher. So whatever happens to us once we start to practice is our teacher, or teaches us. Just this is it. Just this is what you are looking for. We can't believe it because we feel that what we are looking for is caught up in our narrative, caught up in our story, caught up in our agenda. And we find it very difficult to drop that agenda, to drop that narrative, to step outside it and experience things as it is without that narrative. We're always experiencing things as they present themselves to that narrative. So this brings us back to Zen and the schools of Zen. The formalities of Zen are there to help us step outside that narrative or to drop that narrative. They're there to present us with opportunities where we can go, ah, this is it. I get it. So I was at a slideshow once by trying to think of his name. I keep forgetting his name. Maybe if I wrote it down, I would remember it. He's a scholar, and he had been to China, and he took photographs, and he was visiting Chan monasteries in China. The name Bruce Ferguson comes to mind, but I don't think that's correct. I'm hoping that Devin or Michael or Josh or somebody will know. Okay. Who? Okay, but thank you for trying. That's good. Anyhow, he was giving this slideshow, and he came to a monastery in which there were Soto Zen monks and Rinzai Zen monks practicing in the same temple. And there was a guest master there. And he described the guest master as being this like, this quintessential sage-like appearance. You know, he had the goatee, white goatee. And just looked like something out of a classic movie or story. And he says to this guest master, Soto monks and Rinzai monks practicing in the same temple. How does that work? And the guest master goes, strokes his goatee. The Rinzai monks are trying very hard to become enlightened. And that's like expressed in the koan practice. Mu. We chant mu. You know the way we were chanting, oh. They chant mu. Mu. Really get that question into every cell of your body. into the fibers of your being so that you are living mu. What is mu? That's another talk. What is mu? So you get the question into your being so that everything you do is the question. And then someday the question opens or breaks you, basically, breaks that rationality. Okay. So this is the Rinzai monks are trying very hard to become enlightened. And the Soto monks think they already are. Okay. And that's the understanding in Soto, that we are it, we're already it. We don't have to become it. Okay. Now both are true, right? We are it, we're part of the whole, we're included in the whole, we're not separate from it, but we have built up this narrative, this psychology where we see ourselves as being separate from it. And how do we get beyond that prison of separation? And that's where the Rinzai, they have this great determination to break down that prison by using koans. Could call it the Great Escape. And the Rinzai monks are there with their power tools hacking against the wall, and we're more like with spoons chipping away at it slowly, slowly, slowly. But the koan in Soto Zen is we're already enlightened. How is that so? I mean, that's the implicit or implied question. How is that so? And gradually as we practice and we get glimpses of the totality, we just realize that it is so. Ah, this is it after all.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.